Welcome to Week in Review, where we recap events and issues pertinent to Central Illinois. I'm WMBD Radio News Director Will Stevenson. It was announced Friday that the Riverview Plaza building in downtown Peoria at Jefferson and Hamilton Streets, across from the Peoria County Courthouse, would be closed indefinitely. It was shut down by the city and the Peoria Fire Department after people outside the courthouse noticed something was wrong. The story broke first on WMBD Radio Friday morning with WMBD's Greg Batten and Dan DiOrio speaking with Peoria Fire Chief Sean Solberger.
I don't think many people put it in their minds that you help out in car crashes, medical situations, obviously help us with fires, save radio personalities from stuck elevators.
Yes, at least once for me. Thank you very much.
And I think the rest of the time we think, okay, you're just getting your equipment up to date and making chili. We forget about the aspect that part of your safety is inspecting buildings.
That is, we like to say in this, in our profession, this point, this concept, this aspect is like working in the dark. A lot of people forget about that part of it. I know when I came into the industry as a firefighter, I was unaware that that's a function that we perform. And it's a critical facet to the safety of your community, the safety of buildings.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
So today
is just another example.
The reason we're asking you to join us, or ask you to join us, is there's a building downtown that is called Riverview Plaza. A lot of people remember it as Saving Center Tower. That's what it was called years ago. Yeah. It's where the Chase Bank is, and there's a lot of offices, attorneys, and such in that building. And according to the information we have, the building has been closed per orders from the Peoria Fire Department. Can you tell us why?
Yes, so I'll bore you with a short story. We were called last night at about 1600 hours, so 4 p.m., from a person from Peoria County Courthouse saying that there is a substantial amount of water that was coming out of that building.
Out of the building?
Yeah. So normally you would get that via a fire alarm.
Okay.
We didn't get that. So we got this per a phone call, so that's a huge red flag to start. And that a lot of this will make more sense as we talk about this.
Yeah,
we got on the scene, saw that they had a substantial water leak. We were working with their staff to mitigate that. Well, then we start digging deeper. Why did the fire alarm system not trip this alarm? And that's where we're at today. The fire alarm system is not compliant. It's not monitoring. Basically, they get a signal and it's not going anywhere. They've been working with Getz since June of last year. That's one issue. The second issue is that their sprinkler system for a high rise does not work. And so now you have tenants, occupancy in this building. So, and it bleeds over into the Hamilton Street side as well. So you have 111 Jeff, 125 Jeff, and then addresses off of Hamilton that tenants cannot be in there today. We're working with the property management. I believe property ownership is going to be on the scene today. We'll be on the scene working with community development to try to expedite this.
So what it sounds like, it's not like a condemned structural building, but it is a problem, a prevention problem, that needs to be addressed for safety if there's a fire or anything.
Out of compliance.
Yeah, out of compliance if there's a fire and everything. I mean, you from your perspective, it's unsafe to let people go back in until they fix that problem, correct?
That is correct. And so, like I said yesterday with the water leak, those things, when they're hooked up properly with your fire alarm system, we would have gotten the alarm that there is a water leak.
Was it a broken pipe, or was it just activated, though it's sprinkler
system? No, it was a broken pipe. Yeah, they have a significant issue with that, I believe is easy enough for them to remedy. Broken pipes happen often.
Sure.
These are older buildings, older infrastructure. So that part should be fine for them. Now it's helping them with their fire alarm system, which has And I won't dive too incredibly deep. They have substantial issues with their fire alarm system and their sprinkler system.
Let me ask,
going to be there with them today.
I do want to talk about systems for a second in a second, but I want to ask you this first. So today, if I'm a tenant, if I'm an attorney, or I'm a person who rents a space in that building, I can go back in escorted. Am I escorted by the fire department? Is that who's going to take me in?
We could, but generally that's through property owner,
okay.
property management.
The management.
They'll
hire
a security firm.
More
than likely to help people.
Okay.
Get
your stuff, go get your files, go get your whatever it is you need for the next day or two. Is there any
Correct.
Anticipation of how long the building will remain closed?
I probably couldn't answer that accurately. I should be able to at some point today, you know, working with whatever companies they bring in. I know that there's been communication with Getz, with PIPCO, on the sprinkler system side, and then Thompson and Johnson Electric on the fire alarm system side. So I think sometime this morning we should have a better idea on how long this building will stay in this state.
645 WMBD, Greg and Dan, we are talking with the Peoria Chief of the Fire Department, Chief Solberger. The Riverview Plaza building at the corner of Jefferson and Hamilton yesterday evening after the fire department got a report of water coming out of the building from somebody across the street.
Yeah.
That's never
the
good
courthouse,
when somebody
yeah.
sees you across the
yeah.
street and sees the water coming out. Now the building is going to be closed to tenants until some things can be rectified.
How often do you, outside of this is responding to a call, or maybe it's something that you see, but do you regularly go around and inspect buildings that don't have problems, that are just part of a regular inspection?
Yes, in an ideal world, you'd like to be able to say that you can touch 4,000 commercial addresses, and we have over 4,000 commercial addresses in the city of Peoria. And the issue that we're running into is proper staffing. And that's not casting any shade on anybody
sure.
on how we got to this point, but we have one person in the fire department, and his name's Charlie Perrin, and he does plans review. And he doesn't even do inspections. He does them when he can with these commercial structures. But every single plan, so every single renovation, every single build goes through Charlie's desk. And that's just our department, community
wow.
development. They have one person, Rich Storm, that handles buildings. So I think what we're looking at here is probably years, if not decades, of an untenable situation in regards to inspections.
Sure.
Regular inspections. But then you get into enforcement. You know, we've just been talking about this morning because we all got in here at 5 o'clock knowing that we had this significant issue
right.
that you can only do so much, whether you're community development, buildings, fire department, plans review, inspections. Now you're working with building owners knowing that they have code compliance issues. Now it's on the property owner to ensure that they get done. So when you get into an enforcement mechanism standpoint, you only have two routes as a city. Either you can fine them or you can temporarily shut the building down until the issues are rectified. And in either situation is not good.
Right. No, neither is what you would like to have happen. Real quick, one last question back to systems. And again, know uh-huh. that we're all lay people. If you had a magic wand and everybody had the proper amount of funding, What's a great system look like? I mean, for a typical commercial entity, what is that that you like to see?
You like to see that they have regular inspections, regular maintenance and repair, and that they keep proper records. I mean, in the most basic form. So, you know, depending on the size of the building, and this is an extreme example. This is a high rise, 20 stories. And to see that they're doing proper maintenance, proper repair, their 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year inspections. And all of those things lead to where we're at today. Those things are not happening. And an address of this significance, this is where you see systems in disrepair.
Well, you know, Patrick Yurick's got the answer. He told us once, we can fix all the roads and do everything. It just takes money.
So we just need money. We just need a bunch of money. All right, Chief. Thanks for doing what all you folks do for us. We do appreciate it. I know you probably don't hear thanks a lot, but we do appreciate it, whether it's responding to those accidents that we have out there on the roadways or helping our grandparents if they are having an issue at a nursing home. I know you guys do a lot of that stuff,
yeah.
too. And this is of utmost importance. So keep up the good work. We'll talk to you later.
Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Thelung. That's Chief Solberger at the Peoria Fire Department. Again, Riverview Plaza building. If you know somebody that has an office there and they don't know this, the fire department closed them down yesterday, and you've got to go back in with an escort today to get whatever stuff you need.
Peoria Fire Chief Sean Solberger with WMBD's Greg and Dan. Now some news this week on the cancer front. Next Saturday, OSF Healthcare will provide public tours of the new multi-million dollar about-to-open OSF Cancer Institute, located on the campus of St. Francis Medical Center. This week, the media got its chance to look around. WMBD's TJ Carson was among them, and he talked with OSF Central Region CEO Bob Anderson.
We're so excited to be opening in just a few weeks. We have a lot of events next week. We'll be doing a blessing and dedication with the Bishop of Peoria. And then we have open houses throughout the week next week for our mission partners, for physicians, and then for the public on Saturday the 17th.
Before we took the tour, you said a few remarks, and this has been an idea that's been a decade in the making.
It sure has. People have assumed that it's just been since we started digging that this project has been underway. But we actually started in 2014 asking ourselves, where should we place proton therapy on our campus, and how can we make it the best experience for our patients?
And what's been the timeline since that initial thought?
Well, we had to go through a design. We had to work with the State of Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board to get authorization to proceed with the project. And then you have the actual challenges of doing a large project like this during a pandemic, sourcing the materials, getting the contractors. It's certainly been a huge effort to get to where we are today.
And groundbreaking was October 22, if I recall correctly?
Yes, that's correct. And that really kind of kicked off the construction phase of the project. And our trades have been here every day since then, working every day around the entire year.
The main focus of this facility, from what I gathered, is proton therapy, and that is a service that isn't widely available not only here but in the Midwest.
You're correct. Proton therapy is limited in its availability. There is a unit up near Chicago and one in St. Louis. There are none in Indiana or Iowa or Nebraska. So there is a huge draw for patients who need that therapy. I would say that the entire building is really devoted to all kinds of cancer treatments, because proton therapy isn't, you know, for every single type of cancer, but our Cancer Institute is here to serve all patients with any type of cancer.
That lack of access to proton therapy, was that one of the main inspirations for wanting to create the center here?
I think Dr. Jim McGee, who is our director of radiation oncology, came to us well more than 14 years ago to talk about the benefits of this type of therapy. And we recognized that it was something important for our community to have access to. We have patients today that have to make a decision whether they can afford to travel and stay in St. Louis or Chicago, or choose another type of treatment that they can get closer to home, even if it may not be as advantageous for them.
One of the other things I picked up from the tour, and you kind of alluded to that, is just making it easy for people to get the treatment that they need and to have that family support. Talk about how important it was to keep the family and friend support in mind when creating this institute.
Well, I think as people come and tour or have a family member that needs to receive treatment, you'll see that we've thought about how we can bring the family alongside. All of our medical examination areas have the ability to video conference family members that may be at a distance that want to be involved in the discussion. Maybe they have elderly parents and the children are from out of state and want to be part of the discussion. We can do that here.
And there was a lot of talk, too, about having the community embrace those people that are going through one of the toughest battles they may go through.
Well, Peoria is, I think, a very welcoming community. And when you have people that are traveling from out of state, they're here for literally weeks getting treatment. And so they're going to be using our, our lodging facilities. They're going to be using our restaurants, our stores, our businesses. And I think it's just great how welcoming Peoria is to really kind of wrap themselves around those people coming for care.
We talked about the proton therapy. What are some of the other focuses and other technology developments that people can have here at the Cancer Institute?
We also offer brachytherapy, which is traditional radiation therapy, PET CT, which is a type of test that shows where cancer is within the body. We offer all the range of diagnostics like ultrasound, X-ray, laboratory, MRI. We also offer support services, navigation, financial navigation, dietitians, psychosocial therapy. We have a teaching kitchen, community education. You know, the list goes on and on.
There's a lot of talk about those social services as part of the treatment process. What makes that so important in overcoming cancer? You're treating the cancer itself with the radiation, the proton therapy, but it's not just that. It's part of the fight.
It is. It's really kind of a supportive life while you're going through treatment. Treatment's a very small percent of your time that you're being treated, but you're living with cancer all of the time. And so you have questions, you have worries, you know, you want to understand what you're facing. And so we have experts that can help answer those questions, can help guide you, navigate you through how you need to get your appointments set up and how you get your care throughout the cancer journey.
Another feature that it's not quite done yet, and I don't believe the weather has helped with that, but the Healing Garden, we're looking at it right now. Not a lot to it, but it's an important part of this institute.
We knew from the very beginning that we wanted to wrap our building around a restful garden, a place where people could get some respite from the burdens of receiving cancer treatment. And so, yes, we have a beautiful garden here that has walking spaces. It has areas where you can just sit and relax and be within nature, all just footsteps away from the Cancer Institute.
And from what I understand, it also gives back in the sense of growing things here and using what you grow.
Yes, we actually have as part of the garden a herb and vegetable garden that we will be working with patients in the garden, and we'll be using that produce that we grow in our teaching kitchen, showing our patients and their families how you can take these materials and prepare them in a healthy way in order to support your recovery.
One of the things the surgeons brought up as well was just having everything in one location and how important that is in the process, where if someone needed something looked at in a different part of the building, that they can just be brought to where they need to go in minutes. How important was that in the development process for creating this institute?
Well, I think you hit on one of the key elements, is bringing everything together for the benefit of the patient. A lot of the treatments, other than proton therapy, we've been offering for our patients, but they've been in different locations, and it makes it challenging in order to get people from A to B or to see a provider if they need to quickly. Bringing everybody together under one roof really simplifies that and makes it much easier for our patients.
Kind of wrap up here. One of the things I was kind of talked about at the start too is that this is kind of your baby. Now that it's nearing completion and you've walked through it and what you've seen from it, what are some of your thoughts on it? What are some of the feelings and emotions you have?
You know, it's probably hard to talk about without getting choked up. It has been 10 years that I've been involved with this, and I've been involved with other building projects throughout my career. I've been with OSF over 40 years. But this is one that I got to be involved with from conception to reality, and to see what the team has done here, not just the construction crew, but the mission partners here at St. Francis that have worked so hard to make sure that the patient throughput is smooth and seamless, and the experience is going to be first rate.
And opening day, in a way, is not too far away.
No, it's not. February 22nd, we'll start to see our first patients for diagnostic testing as well as for infusions. And then in March, we will begin seeing patients for proton therapy, brachytherapy, and we'll be opening the physician practices on the third floor. I just want to welcome everyone to come and tour the facility on Saturday, the 17th of February. We'll have an open house, and everyone's welcome to come take a look.
WMBD's TJ Carson and OSF Healthcare Central Region CEO Bob Anderson. Country music star Toby Keith died this past week at the age of 62, following a multi-year battle with stomach cancer. Keith, who supported the troops and had several number one hits on the country music charts, played a few Las Vegas shows back in December, despite what he calls, quote, a little bit of a roller coaster with the stomach cancer. Stomach cancer itself may either be not that big of a deal in the United States or a big deal going undiagnosed. I talked about it with Dr. Patrick Fernandez, a radiation oncologist with the Carle Health Cancer Institute in Normal.
Cancer, stomach cancer is unfortunately very rare in the Western world, including USA, but it is very prevalent in some parts of the world, especially the Far East, Japan, Korea, China, and that's got to do with a lot of factors. So, and that's the reason why we don't hear much about stomach cancer talked about in this country. Nevertheless, I think clearly these tumors present too late because the patient, the person doesn't understand when they have a little bit of heartburn. You know, they maybe they just overlook it like most of us do, take some Tums, and maybe it goes away, maybe it doesn't. But the thing is, the importance here is, again, the issue of early cancer detection and screening and prevention. So even though gut cancer, stomach cancer, we do not have a policy of catching it early, countries in Japan and like Japan and Korea, where it is rampant, they do scopes very frequently. And therefore, they're able to catch it at an early stage. And that is where the crux is for any cancer. We want to catch it at an early stage. And that's why I think cancer being the second most cause of disease causing mortality, we need to, as citizens, as people, be aware and we take cancer seriously and be cognizant of the symptoms that one can get with the side effects. And basically common sense things like if things don't go away, like if you have a heartburn which doesn't go away with treatment, if you have some bleeding, if you have a voice that gets hoarse and doesn't get better, and if you have a lump that doesn't make sense in that location. So it's a question of not taking it for granted, but going and seeking medical attention, because you may be the lucky one where it is caught early. And that is the whole purpose of us being very vigilant. And it's part of the curriculum. It's not just about heart, where we take more we are concerned and we seek medical attention. These things are important. And going to the doctor once a year for an annual checkup, where you have to tell the person has to know that he has a family history of cancer. That makes him even more susceptible to cancer, and therefore the family doctor will take it seriously and make sure that he gets the necessary tests. And one more thing I would like to say is that 20 to 25% of cancer can be preventable. I mean, this is something which is surprising. All by just choosing a healthy diet, a balanced diet of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, beans, avoid cut down meat and red meat, maintain a healthy weight, doing physical therapy for at least 30 minutes to prevent obesity, avoid tobacco, avoid excessive alcohol consumption, everything in moderation, protect your skin from sun and ultraviolet radiation. Just by sticking to these things, you can prevent 25% of cancer.
It sounds to me like you're saying, though, at least in terms of stomach cancer, that this is the sort of thing that might otherwise get misdiagnosed.
Correct. So again, because it is the symptoms are so benign initially, you know, you get a heartburn or you get a little bit of pain in that area, you overlook it. But again, in a country like Japan, where it is very prevalent, they have periodic checkup. Every 3 or 6 months, they put down the scope and look. So you can catch it early. But in our country, thankfully, because it is not prevalent, it's not a common cancer, I think it's too expensive for the government. The benefits do not outweigh the, you know, it's an overkill to put scope in everybody's stomach. So Keith Tobey had a rare cancer by Western standards.
What causes it, though? Misdiagnosis a part of the concern?
Correct. There are various causes. In our country, we get cancer of the esophagus, and the upper part of the stomach, which is very close. And that's mainly due to GERD, reflux esophagitis. There can also be a connection with excessive alcoholism, although it is not clearly known. And there are a string of other causes, like some bacterial, like Helicobacter pylori. That's a specific bacteria which stays in the gut, in the stomach, and can cause some kinds of cancer. And the last thing, which is not insignificant, is family history. Ultimately, everything is genetic. There is always a genetic component, and it is possible that Keith Toby must have had a family history of cancer, which predisposes him to cancer any part of the body. And for some unfortunate reason, he must have had a bad cell residing in his stomach, which kept growing. So it's very, very complicated. And so it's what can I say? Bad luck.
Yeah.
The important thing is to be vigilant and not to take it for granted when you have any early symptoms which do not go away with medication or antibiotics. I don't think you miss it. The problem is when it is very small also in the stomach, then I agree it's very, very difficult to catch it. And it has to grow to a certain size for it to be seen by the naked eye or on a scan. So that is the conundrum. But again, I'm going back to Japan. They have found ways and means of using high-resolution imaging technique and scope to catch these even at an early stage. So it's all got to do with, let's say stomach cancer was very common in this country. We would have had a program whereby everybody would be having scopes of those who are more prone to it. So it's not that you're missing it. It's just that it is. It's in a location which is very tricky, and so there we go.
All right. In terms of, I wanted to ask you. Maybe it's related to this, maybe not so much. But I've kept hearing stories the last number of weeks of younger people getting various forms of cancer that maybe weren't always found until someone in the past. Someone would get older. Is that something you're finding in general in terms of cancer, that more younger people are getting forms of cancer?
No, it's not that more younger people are getting most forms of cancer. It's just because we now have good diagnostic tools to catch the cancer at an early stage. And to answer your question more specifically, there are some cancers where you see it in younger individuals, and that is there. Like sometimes rectal cancer, some types of head and neck cancers, some type of brain cancers, you see it in the younger generation. Now, again, I'm going back. When you get a cancer in a younger person, it is genetic. It is familial. It is hereditary. So these people, unfortunately, are born with that abnormal gene, and it just manifests at an early stage. So that's where there's something called genetic counseling now, you know, where there is people with family history of malignancy. If they get a cancer, they meet a genetic counselor who counsels them, finds out about their whole family history, and looks and finds out if there's any syndrome that they belong to, where they can do some tests and catch these cancers in early stage. This is in its infancy, and it's coming up in a big way. So to answer your question, it has got to do with the familial origin that these unfortunate young patients get cancer.
Dr. Patrick Fernandez, radiation oncologist with Carle Health Cancer Institute in Normal. How about a nice game of chess? Hundreds of high school students from around the state have been at the Peoria Civic Center this weekend for the Illinois High School Association State Chess Tournament. WMBD's TJ Carson checked In with Dan Lee, Assistant Executive Director at the IHSA, overseeing the tournament.
And a special mark being that this is the 50th anniversary of the IHSA Team Chess State Final. So we brought 128 teams here today to compete, and be crowning some a state champion and handing out some other awards tomorrow.
Is it typically 128 teams that show up?
Yeah, 128 teams. So sectionals were held 2 weeks ago, and so that helps us narrow down the field to the 128 teams that we have competing here today.
50 years. Let's reflect on that for a moment. That's a long time and a long continuous effort to promote chess in the state.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a lot of credit goes to Mike Zakate. He's considered as the founder or the father of Illinois high school chess. It was his brainchild back in the late 60s, and he did create kind of a tournament on his own. And then the IHSA took it over starting in the 1974-75 school year. So the spring of 1975 was when the first IHSA Team Chess State Championship was held. And, it brings us 50 years, and that's just credit to Mike and all of the officials and coaches who have promoted chess over the years and to help it grow to what it is today. This year we had the most schools participate in our IHSA Team Chess State Series with 163 this year. So we're hoping to see that trend continue and continue to see that growth in the sport of chess.
How have you seen high school chess grown? And we weren't around when it started in 74, but how have you seen it grown in the past 10, 20 years?
Well, this is only my second year administering the tournament, but just from the history that I've learned and kind of gathered and researched, there was a point in time where, there wasn't a sectional round. There wasn't a cutoff for the schools that participated in the state tournament. It was if you had a high school chess team and you wanted to participate, you could. But it grew over time to the point where it became too many schools, so they had to develop that sectional round, which started in 2018, to help narrow the field down to a manageable 128. So, I mean, that's just a sign of the growth over the course of the 20, 30, 40 years in the sport. And like I said, we set a new record this year with 163, and so it's continuing to grow, and we hope to see that continue.
How many students are participating this weekend? I know you mentioned 128 teams. How many students do we have here?
I would say somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 students altogether. Each team may roster up to 12 for participation this weekend. When they compete, eight on eight in the team format. We expect around somewhere between 1,400 and 1,500 here.
That's a lot of students.
It's a lot of students. If you look in the ballroom, you will see 64 tables, and those are all filled those seats are all filled. And then obviously, a lot of people standing around and spectating as well that are also part of the teams taking in the event.
Now, for those who may not be familiar, how does the competition play out? What's the format? How do we determine a winner by tomorrow afternoon?
Yeah, so it's a little different when you compare it to other, sports and tournaments that are bracketed and based on seed. So we do have all the teams seeded, 1 through 128. And, again, what's different about chess is, what you would think is maybe, seed number 1 is going to play seed number 128 in round 1. That's not the case in chess. To create better pairings and better matchups, when they split it down the middle, seed number 1 actually plays seed number 65 in round 1, and number 2 plays 66, and so on. And so it's a 7-round tournament. It's 8-on-8, and each board is weighted a certain number of points. So your top board, your number 1 board, so the number 1 players from both teams, the winner of that match will earn 12 points for their team. All the way down to board number 8, which earns 4 points for the team. And so as matches finish, whether they end up in draws where they split the points or they win and claim all the points, you add all those points together for each team, and that's how we determine a winner. And we just kind of progress throughout the weekend as more teams keep winning. You eventually hope to get to the point where in round 7 we have 2 undefeated teams through the weekend, and they will be playing each other for the state championship tomorrow.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. The ELO system, is that used here?
We do not use the ELO system. So everything is just through our member schools and with the coaches and their knowledge and their results from the season. So we do have a committee of coaches that get together to see the tournament, based on their conferences and leagues, just based on the information that they have and can collect from there. And so the coaches get together and take in that information. And since this is a team tournament, they take the team into consideration as a whole instead of the individual, and they again rank the teams 1 through 128.
50 years. So let's go back to that for a moment. What does that tell you about the longevity? Just what makes this 50th anniversary so special?
Yeah, I think it's just kudos and credit to the dedication that, you know, Mike Zakate had and the vision he had, and then obviously just credit to all the coaches and the officials that have been a part of this tournament for so long. And at the IHSA, Scott Johnson, he's a retired IHSA administrator who oversaw this tournament for a long time. His work and, you know, kind of dedication to this event, too, is, has kind of built it to what it is here. He actually programmed the scoring system that we use for the tournament, so coaches are able to enter in results as matches finish on their phones. It all tabulates, you know, goes to one central system. So Scott's done a lot of work to help us progress with this tournament that I've heard, you know, coaches mentioned that they wish that system was available for other tournaments, you know, non-IHSA tournaments throughout the year. But yeah, so I think just with the 50 years and just the work and that's been done by those before us, I think it just has brought us to where we are today.
Peoria has been the site for this tournament for a long time now. What makes Peoria the spot that you want to hold this final at?
Yeah, I think it's obviously, you know, kind of a centrally located area in the state for us, so where we're bringing schools from the north and from the south, and we can kind of meet in a little bit more of a centralized location. But also the Civic Center here is a great space for it. Obviously, with 128 teams, we need a large competition area that has enough of the tables and chairs and things that we need, which the Civic Center is able to provide. And then we also need a secondary space to house the teams when they're not playing, which is, again, the Civic Center is able to provide that space for us and create that lounge, which is called the Skittles area in Chess, and they're able to create that lounge downstairs for our teams. So again, I think, yeah, just geographically it makes sense, and just the facility itself makes a lot of sense for the tournament.
It's a kind of a perfect place here in Peoria.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Any favorite memories of the tournament? I know you mentioned you haven't been running the tournament in a long, but you've been involved in it in a long time. So any favorite memories from the event?
Well, in just 2 years of doing this now, you know, I think it's just the most memorable part to me is just once the competition starts. I think, you know, there's that excitement, there's that buzz with all the 128 teams getting here, and when we get everybody into the ballroom for the competition, and we kind of go over the just the final instructions before play. I think there's just that level of excitement and buzz, and everyone's just looking forward to get started. So when we say, you know, you may start your clocks and round one begins, everybody gets going, and all 128 teams are making their first moves, and I think that's just an exciting time, and it's pretty neat to see.
What do you see for the future for this tournament, for growth here in Peoria, just anything you see for the future?
Yeah, I think, as I said, we're seeing a growth in the number of participating teams. I know there are some schools that originally had signed up and just, for whatever reason, just weren't able to, get their teams together for this year. So I just hope to continue to see the growth amongst Illinois high schools that are forming teams and want to be a part of it. And so as that grows, we'll see where the future takes us in terms of our sectional tournaments and how it impacts that, whether that means we need to add more sectionals, or does this mean eventually in the future, do we need to create a regional round of competition? I think just seeing that, consistent growth over the years, and hope to see that continue to happen. And like I said, we will adjust as needed as we get more participation.
Can fans show up this weekend to watch?
Yep, absolutely. It's free to the public. Spectators are allowed to come in. The only thing we ask is just, your electronic devices stay in your pockets when you're in the competition area, just to maintain the integrity of the tournament. But yeah, public is certainly welcome, and you can cheer silently.
Any thoughts on anything else?
No, I appreciate the time. This is, it's a great event. Again, we bring, not many of our state championships bring this many people together, I would say. And so this is a unique one where we're able to bring, like I said, nearly 1,500 students to the event to take part in a great weekend of high level of competition. But also, these teams can enjoy the moment and can say they participated in the state tournament. And specifically this year, they can say they took part in the 50th annual one.
Illinois High School Association Executive Director Dan Lee with WMBD. He's TJ Carson. That does it for this edition of Week in Review. Join us again next week on this Midwest Communications Station for another recap of some of the biggest issues and events in Central Illinois. I'm Will Stevenson, WMBD Radio News.